This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Brazil voices support for a common trading currency with BRICS members ahead of the Johannesburg summit as efforts to ditch the dollar gain momentum. Iran says that it has already taken the extra mile in combating money laundering, stressing that the Financial Action Task Force should not be used as a political tool. And also, over 1,000 people are still unaccounted for 2 weeks after the deadliest wildfires in recent U.S. history hit Hawaii. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Top story for this half hour: the Russian president has highlighted the accelerating momentum of de-dollarization as he addressed a business forum of the BRICS grouping in South Africa's Johannesburg.
The irreversible objective process of de-dollarization of our economic ties is gaining momentum, and efforts are being made to develop effective mechanisms for mutual settlements and monetary control. As a result, the share of the dollar in export-import transactions within the BRICS is declining. Last year, it amounted to only 28.7%.
In a virtual address, Vladimir Putin also criticized the sanctions policy of Western states, saying such practice is seriously affecting the international economic situation. He said the unlawful freezing of assets of sovereign states constitutes a violation of free trade and economic cooperation rules. The Brazilian president, who has traveled to South Africa to attend the BRICS summit, also addressed the business forum. He voiced support for economic cooperation among bloc members, including the plan to develop a common trading currency.
I have been defending the idea of adopting a common trading currency for trade that won't replace our national currencies.
BRICS is an acronym for the bloc of major developing economies of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The bloc is expected to consider granting new memberships during a three-day summit, as over 40 countries have expressed interest in joining it. They include Iran, that applied for the membership last year. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has also been invited to Johannesburg to take part in the summit. BRICS is a consensus-based organization. Every five members must agree on the principle of expansion and criteria for new members. Political commentator Reg Nkosi believes that BRICS is going to become the top global institution, as its economic power is already huge, and new members would make it even stronger.
The BRICS countries have now exceeded the G7 in terms of economic clout. That is fundamentally important. And with newer nations joining the BRICS, countries like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, Indonesia, and many others, frankly, the economic power has tilted away from the West to the global South. And quite frankly, I think in the next coming 5 years, BRICS is going to be the only institution globally that matter because of the significance of the economies that are there already, South Africa and Africa, Russia, China, and Mania, and India. These are important economies, and the additions of these others will certainly be a game changer globally, geoeconomically, and geopolitically as well.
Iran's Ministry of Economic Affairs and Finances held the country's first conference on combating money laundering and financing terrorism in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 managers from different institutions have attended this seminar. The conference is set to provide a perfect platform for Iranian organizations to achieve synergy in combating money laundering.
Money laundering. Simply put, it means one conceals the origin of the money obtained from illicit activities. The term money laundering is said to have its origins in the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s. Most gangsters, such as Al Capone, used laundries as a cover for the illegal money they made because the amount of cash flowing into laundry operations was challenging to track. This way, large sums of money could be processed without being noticed.
Governments have been dealing with this issue for decades, working hard to put an end to it. In 2008, Iran established the Economy Ministry's Financial Intelligence Unit, or FIU, headed by the country's economy minister for this purpose. On Tuesday, the FIU held Iran's first national anti-money laundering and financing terrorism conference in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 senior managers from different institutions took part in this seminar to discuss strengthening and developing necessary infrastructure to prevent and deal with corruption, especially money laundering. Speaking on the sidelines of the conference, Iran's economy minister Ehsan Khanduzi said the Islamic Republic has higher standards in blocking the path of money laundering and financing terrorism compared to many countries in the world.
According to the financial and judicial reports, important measures have been taken in Iran in the field of fighting against money laundering and financing terrorism, which is unprecedented. We expect the FATF working group to adopt a technical approach in its evaluation instead of a political approach.
Khanduzi also pointed to Iran's membership at the Financial Action Task Force, saying Tehran's position in the FATF is active, not passive. Organizers of the conference say it has provided a perfect platform for the senior managers of Iranian organizations to achieve synergy in combating money laundering.
Keeping Iran's financial system healthy is one of the priorities of the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi. In this regard, Tehran has been taking serious steps to combat money laundering and deal with disruptors of the economy. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
The head of the Financial Intelligence Unit of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hadi Khani, says the Islamic Republic has gone an extra mile in combating money laundering. He made the remarks on the sidelines of the first national anti-money laundering and funding terrorism conference in Tehran. Let's have a look.
We believe that our laws and regulations, infrastructure, approaches, and determination of our government and institutions testify that the Islamic Republic has managed to fight money laundering and terrorist financing in a way that fully covers international standards. We have even acted beyond that. Despite Iran's internal challenges as well as regional situations, many measures the country has taken are more than what the FATF had demanded from other nations. We are focused on enforcing our own laws and regulations, organize our bylaws and instructions in proportional to our interests. We have maximum transparency in our financial system. Regarding the FATF, it has been said before that the Islamic Republic pursues an active approach. We acclaim our achievements. We have recently reported our activities to the Eurasian Group on combating money laundering and financing of terrorism. We believe that if the FATF acts based on a technical framework and not the political one, we have a lot to offer to the international community.
Well, an Iranian national who has been illegally imprisoned in Sweden since 2019 has lamented his ordeal in the European country's jail. Hamid Nouri told his family in a phone call that he's been held in solitary confinement for nearly 4 years. Nouri said that prison authorities strip him naked every week for body search. He also complained that he has been rarely allowed to make contact with his family. Back in November 2019, Nouri was arrested upon arrival at Stockholm Airport. Swedish prosecutors accused him of being involved in the execution of members of anti-Iran Mujahideen-e-Khalq, or MEK, terrorist organization. He has rejected the accusations as politically motivated. Joining us now from Tehran, we have Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Mr. Masoud Shajadeh. Mr. Shajadeh, welcome to the program. Talk to us about Hamid Nouri's ordeal and the treatment that he's receiving.
Well, there are a couple of issues here. On one side, if we are led to believe the sincerity of Sweden, we really need to sort of look at why at such a time they are prosecuting someone who they claim was involved in sort of abuse of due process in Iran in dealing with what is known a terrorist organization. And if you compare that with what the United States and the West is doing, using drones, which is extrajudicial killing, which results in killing not just those who they are judge, jury, and execute, but innocent people. and not a single person from that process, which actually killed hundreds of thousands and millions of people in the last 10, 15, 20 years, have been ever prosecuted by anyone in the West, let alone Sweden. That is one issue which actually exposes the lack of sincerity. The other thing is actually, why is it very clearly they're abusing their own processes, their due processes, in prosecution to start with? Because having spoken to the lawyers, they are saying that all their due processes have been undermined by the prosecutors. And now, even in prison, their processes have been undermined. He's being kept in the solitary confinement, which is unlawful in Sweden. And the way that he's been abused, weekly sort of strip searching, etc., etc. These are processes that is known internationally to be against international law, against the human right, and indeed is only used by those who actually want to abuse an individual systematically. So systematic abuse of the rights of individual is totally unacceptable. And, you know, Sweden cannot sort of do all these things at the same time, trying to sort of present itself as, you know, champions of justice, human rights, etc. I think this needs to be exposed for what it is.
All right, thanks a lot. Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajar, joining us from Tehran. Moving on, an Iraqi anti-terror movement has taken the lid off U.S. plans for maintaining military presence in the Arab country. The Secretary General of the Asad al-Haq movement said the main goal of the American military presence in Iraq is to ensure security of the Israeli regime. Sheikh Reis al-Ghazali said the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq is inevitable since the country is capable of defending itself. He blamed former Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi for failing to take any real steps to end the American combat presence in Iraq. The U.S. has kept 2,500 soldiers in Iraq under the pretext of assisting local forces in combating the Daesh terror group. This comes against the backdrop of growing calls for the complete withdrawal of all American troops from the country. And Palestinian fishermen in the besieged Gaza Strip put their lives in danger each time they go fishing to make a living amid threats posed by Israeli naval forces. Ola Alassi reports from Gaza.
Fishing is the second most important sector in the Gaza Strip's economy, but has become amongst the most dangerous jobs there. The fishing industry in Gaza is not viable anymore due to the Israeli naval blockade, which has stifled it, inflicting misery on the Palestinian fishermen. Fishermen are always forced to stay close to the shore in shallow waters, where they struggle for a catch.
The Israeli occupation has been systematically and deliberately destroying the fishing sector for the last 16 years. Israeli gunboats harass, shoot at, and abduct the Palestinian fishermen and destroy their equipment and confiscate their boats. Gaza's maritime borders are only 40 kilometers for fishing, but in fact, we have zero nautical miles. Israeli authorities prevent the entry of the fishing equipment, engines, and spare parts. All these tactics have affected the fishing industry and pushed it into crisis. Half of the Palestinian fishermen in Gaza are living below the poverty line.
Palestinian fishermen get strip searched and detained when they go more than 3 nautical miles from the shore, and are subjected to deliberate murder by the Israeli naval forces. Mahmoud Becker is one of the Palestinian fishermen who was arrested up to 3 times, detained and injured many times by the rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces. The last time he was injured was in 2018, when he lost his eye.
We can't sail peacefully in the sea. Israeli gunboats chase us and spray water, or open fire at us to destroy our equipment. When we go to the sea, we risk our lives to make a living. Sometimes we never make it back home. In 2018, I was shot with prohibited dum-dum bullets, which expanded in my head and led to loss of my eyesight. I was shot in my arm, abdomen, and head. Since then, I couldn't go fishing again with one eye. Nowadays, I maintain fishing nets. I barely support my family.
The fishing industry has become precarious. Fishermen in Gaza struggle with the increasing operating costs, as the Israeli regime prevents Palestinians from having access to the fishing equipment and fiberglass needed to manufacturing the boats. They also suffer from the increasing fuel prices and scarcity of fish. Most of the fishermen can barely make ends meet.
When we hear the shooting by the Israeli gunboats, we get scared and our families rush to the shore to check on the fishermen. My husband used to spend days at sea and sometimes came out without a sufficient amount of fish. We often spend months without eating fish. When my husband was arrested, it was tragic for our children. I became their mother and father. After he lost his eye, it has become impossible to meet my children's needs. Three of them suffer different illnesses.
Israel's policy against the fishing sector in the Gaza Strip is a form of collective punishment and amount to a war crime. Last week, Israeli naval forces arrested 6 fishermen, injured 4, and confiscated 2 boats and destroyed the bigger one.
Living under the Israeli occupation means living in a constant state of suppression and persecution. The sea for Gazans is not only a source of enjoyment, but also a source of suffering. Al Al-Asib, Gaza.
Over 1,000 people are still missing some 2 weeks after devastating wildfires ravaged parts of the U.S. state of Hawaii. Authorities have put the number of missing people at around 1,100. The FBI is seeking the help of family members in identifying the remains of the dead. They've been collecting DNS samples from those who were out of the, or rather DNA samples, typo there, from those who are out of the fire-ravaged Maui County. 115 people have so far been confirmed dead in the wildfires that were described as the worst in recent U.S. history. Blazes forced harrowing escapes and displaced thousands. Officials have been criticized for failing to issue alerts and their lackluster response to the tragedy. Hawaii's attorney general has already opened an investigation into the authorities' handling of the fires. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
The whole world is silent towards oppression. Even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
A World Trade Organization panel issued a report on Wednesday, 16th of August, regarding China-US trade and China's countermeasures against US tariffs. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. China's Global Times has covered this story and tells us more. It is the United States that has ruined the global multilateral trade system with the WTO at its core, and China's countermeasures against US tariffs on steel and aluminium products is a self-defensive move that follows international practice, Chinese observers and officials have confirmed. Following U.S. trade officers' groundless accusations against China's duty measures on Wednesday. Dismissing a statement from the Office of the United States Trade Representative, China's Commerce Ministry, late on Wednesday, 16th of August, said China's countermeasures against the U.S. Section 232 tariffs on steel and aluminium, which was imposed in 2018, are a legitimate act to safeguard its own rights and interests. The response comes after a World Trade Organization panel issued a report on Wednesday, 16th of August, regarding China's countermeasures. The United States Trade Representative, citing the ruling, claiming Chinese measures has caused grave systemic damage to the World Trade Organization. An official from the China's Ministry of Commerce said the ministry has taken note of the World Trade Organization panel report on Wednesday. It is studying the report and will follow up on it in accordance with the World Trade Organization rules. The root cause of the problem in this case is the unilateral and protectionist moves of the United States, the Chinese official said, adding that China's countermeasures were taken in accordance with the law and are legitimate actions to safeguard the country's legitimate rights and interests. The Chinese official said, "The United States insisted on going its own way, obstructed the entry into force of the expert panel's ruling, evaded its obligations and refused to cancel the illegal tariff measures." In December of 2022, the World Trade Organization ruled the U.S. Section 232 tariffs imposed on steel and aluminium products in 2018 on the grounds of national security, contravened the organization's regulations, recommending the United States to bring its actions into conformity with WTO rules. In 2018, the former Donald Trump administration used national security as a pretext to wave its tariff stick, including imposing tariffs on steel and aluminium products, which caused outrage among the international community. Many countries at that time filed lawsuits in the World Trade Organization, and the WTO made the ruling in 2022 as a response. But the United States has not carried out any actions to implement the ruling up until today. China demands that the US immediately cancel the steel and aluminium Section 232 measures that violate World Trade Organization rules and work with other WTO members in the same direction to maintain the rules-based multilateral trading system together. The Chinese Commerce Ministry official emphasized. Tian Yun, a veteran economist based in Beijing, said that because the United States' actions have infringed upon China's legitimate interests, it is entirely reasonable and lawful for China to counteract through the World Trade Organization platform using relevant rules. Tu Qingquan, Dean of the China Institute for World Trade Organization Studies at the University of International Business and Economics in Beijing, said China is not the only country taking action, as several other countries and economies, including the European Union, have also implemented retaliatory measures against the United States. Chinese observers and officials also criticized the United States for abusing national security and undermining the authority of the World Trade Organization and the global trade system while shifting the blame onto China. It is clear that the U.S.'s misuse of national security to impose unlawful trade restrictions goes against World Trade Organization principles. America's failure to comply with WTO rulings and its continued abuse of national security measures have seriously undermined the rules and authority of the World Trade Organization. The fundamental purpose of the U.S. imposing Section 232 tariffs is to implement its trade protectionism, develop and protect its domestic industries, and revive its manufacturing sector. Since the beginning of the trade war launched by the Trump administration in 2018, the United States has unilaterally imposed sanctions on countries including China, which posed a serious challenge to China's legitimate industrial rights and the fairness of WTO rules, Tian told the Global Times on Thursday, 17th of August. By treating China as its main enemy and seeking confrontational behavior within the World Trade Organization, the United States is effectively dividing the organization and posing a significant threat to the global trade system. The World Trade Organization's appellate body has been paralyzed since 11th of December 2019, after the U.S. blocked the appointment of new members, dealing a heavy blow to the multilateral trading system. The possibility that the United States has deliberately hindered the functioning of the World Trade Organization's appellate body to delay the ruling cannot be ruled out, which is why it has taken more than 4 years for the World Trade Organization to rule against the United States' Section 232 tariffs. Bai Ming, the deputy director of the International Market Research Institute at the Chinese Academy of International Trade and Economic Cooperation, emphasized to the Global Times on Thursday, 17th of August. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. China has said it took trade measures against the United States to safeguard its legitimate rights and interests. Reacting to a report by the World Trade Organization, China's Commerce Ministry said late on Wednesday, 16th of August, the root cause of the problem, in this case, is the unilateral and protectionist moves of Washington. The World Trade Organization said on Wednesday, 16th of August, that China acted inconsistently with international obligations by imposing additional duties on U.S. imports, when former President Donald Trump's administration had imposed a 25% duty on steel imports and a 10% duty on aluminium imports from China. However, China's Commerce Ministry recalled that since March of 2018, the United States has generalized the definition of national security and enforced tariffs on steel and aluminium products shipped to the United States by several WTO members, including China. The United States insisted on going its own way, obstructing the entry into force of the expert panel's ruling, evading its obligations, and refused to cancel the illegal tariff measures, China's Commerce Ministry said in a statement. The statement added, China's countermeasures were taken in accordance with the law and are legitimate actions to safeguard the country's legitimate rights and interests. Beijing demands that the United States immediately cancel the steel and aluminium measures that violate World Trade Organization rules and principles and work with other World Trade Organization member states in the same direction to maintain the rules-based multilateral trading system together.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Black and white.
La degradación del medio ambiente.
In general, environmental degradation is a phenomenon of our times. The types of economy and production cause these catastrophic events. There is also one more reason: how humans have interacted with natural resources. Undoubtedly, humans are an integral part of the environment. Humans impact the environment. The environment is meaningless without the human being who values it, takes care of its quality, and ensures its existence. But in the case of humans, we don't talk about them in abstract terms. We're talking about humans who form societies with certain characteristics, with forms of production, with social, economic, and cultural aspects. They harm a number of humans, in some cases, and benefit a minority. According to data from the United Nations, in 2016, 90% of the wastewater in developing countries, without being processed, flows into rivers and lakes. This same United Nations report also states that in that same year of environmental crisis, 2016, approximately 7 million people died worldwide due to climate issues. The World Health Organization, WHO, states that in the last decade, 95% of natural catastrophes have caused a total of 600,000 deaths, of which 95% belong to poor countries. The issue is how we can achieve environmental justice that is closely related to social justice with a paradigm shift, with a change in society, a change in the relationship between the production, distribution, and uses of natural resources. How are science and technology used at the service of environmental quality? Because our treatment of the environment has impacts on us as well. Humans are a part of environment. For the same reason, there aren't any contradictions nor struggles between humans and the environment. Such an opinion is absurd and absolutely false. We shall consider it as a whole. We can only speak of an environmental change to the extent that there is a social change and a change in the relations of production and profit. We should realize how development is closely related to the sustainable nature of the environment. According to science and technology, we need a sustainable and transformable environment for development and for the benefit of quality of life. Ultimately, we are aware, at least on our part, that the environment is the common home of humans and all the species that live in it. But indisputably, humans are the ones who value it the most. We are humans, and it is our responsibility to take care of environmental quality. Today, profound transformations of a social nature are being proposed, without which there is no environmental change, without which there cannot be a favorable environment for the majority or for humanity as a whole. The liberation of humanity as a whole depends on environmental change. I'm Eduardo Artes. This is Black and White. Today in our program, I talked to Cristobal Rodriguez. He's an environmental activist and advocate. He's also a member of an organization which has a very long name. Please introduce yourself and the organization.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Eduardo. I'm a member of Movement for the Defense of Access to Water, Land and Environmental Protection.
Bienvenido, Cristobal.
You are very welcome to our program. What is the role of environmental movement on the international, national, and Latin American levels? What is the relationship between this movement and the proposals for social transformation, together with the trade union movements, social movements, villagers, indigenous people, etc.?
Your first question is very interesting because we're currently experiencing an unprecedented climate crisis. These organized movements can come up with suggestions in face of socio-environmental conflicts. The whole world is affected by this crisis. We cannot allow life on Earth to be at these critical levels. We have observed different international reports that tell us about the increase in temperatures throughout the world. This undoubtedly has repercussions. For example, regarding trade unions, it affects all productive activities that are based on some natural resources. Talking about fishing, when the temperature rises in the ocean, there is less diversity in the sea. In agricultural terms, there is a shortage of rainfall. Global warming and climate change also affect the mining. That is why it is a global movement.
Perfecto, pero...
Well, is there any conflict of interest between environmental and trade union movements? Imagine that one of these causes environmental contamination. I know that there are many reasons. For instance, the companies don't spend the amount of money needed or many other ones. But sometimes there is an inconsistency between environmental and trade union movements. I think that this problem is related to everyone.
Of course, we also have to understand that we, as humans, workers of labor unions and companies, are parts of an ecosystem. We shall have a permanent and careful dialogue. In the environmental movement in Chile, we have realized that if we are not capable of taking care of our natural resources, we cannot have a job. Cities are becoming unsustainable over time. So I think that before addressing the extent of work, we must face the dimension of sustainable living. There are going to be waves of migrations due to climate change. We witnessed that phenomenon in Central America. Climate change decreases the amount of cultivation, and that is why this amount of population has to immigrate to find sources of work. We should not exclusively look at it just as a contrast between things, but it is a more complementary phenomenon.
We shall consider it as a model of a different society. When the Industrial Revolution develops, it obviously creates a type of relationship formed from environmental defects that include well-being of the workers, young people, children, etc. Who suffers? A large number of people, while others aren't harmed.
That's right. We know that the climate crisis is going to affect the poorest populations in the world. But we also have to highlight the responsibility of great producing powers in this same crisis. So there's an expansion of certain economies during the Industrial Revolution, which affects countries like Chile. The climate crisis impacts third world countries and countries in the global south as well. If we consider the world or the planet Earth as a system, we cannot allow it to continue happening. Any transformation or change within an ecosystem has repercussions in all parts. We're not the only ones who face water crisis. Water crisis has repercussions in local, regional, national, subcontinental, and continental development, and ultimately the entire world. This development model has caused a very serious problem.
This development model causes a serious problem. There are some cases at the international level that different sectors of society, along with workers who were interested in the environmental issue, could come together and raise their voices. It happened in Argentina and Europe. We are in Chile right now. Did we have such an experience? Was there any unanimous voice in defense of the environment that considered the quality of life of all the people?
This point is very important. Most of the time, our general conception is that the environmental issue doesn't have political, economic, and social aspects. When we talk about the environmental issue, all these variables are included. For instance, in case of Chile, the largest holders of capital, like Luxic Group and Angelini Group, generate their wealth from the possession of natural resources. In this scenario, we face an economic problem. Recently, we witnessed the Corpesca case. Jaime Orpiz is released from his pretrial detention due to the fishing law. That is why natural resources have a political component. We highlight these social problems when we talk about the poorest population in Chile that has a productive field essentially based on monoculture. So the first thing we have to do is generate those visions and stop thinking that the environmental issue isn't related to the political, social, and cultural aspects. What kind of experience do we have in Chile? I think that we live in a country where neoliberalism emerged in the most radical way. For example, as a movement, we have the governance of Valparaíso, that is the second largest region in Chile. So we question this centralism by occupying the institutions for the decentralization of the country. This is a vivid example to reverse these failed development model policies.
It is a development model proven to be unsuccessful. This model actually doesn't benefit the people. Let's have a break, and then we continue our program immediately. We continue our talk in black and white with Cristobal Rodriguez, who is an environmental defender. As a member of this environmental movement, what do you think about this discrepancy between development and developmental sustainability according to social conceptions? I believe that humans are the ones that determine everything in the end. I mean that everything is related to them, who are in the center of everything.
Your question is very interesting because it represents a paradigm shift. It also helps us to stop thinking that growth and development are unlimited. We must put the limit to growth. We've been in the ecological overshoot of planet Earth for a couple of weeks. This means that we are almost following the neoliberal principles of living in debt. As a movement, we believe that we have to start talking about a new economic model to replace the current one. This new economic model should not question sustainability of life on Earth, the respect of human rights, and the conservations not only of the species, but also of our indigenous people. So we come to realize that humans are a part of the whole, and we're not necessarily the most important component of this system.
We're not the most important ones?
No necesariamente. Not necessarily. We shall consider ourselves as complementary entities within this system. It's not the theory of the system. The span of species are not important in this system. We are equally important in this system. I insist on the word system because we cannot consider things in an individualistic way, but rather a part of the whole.
Individualista, sino como parte de un todo.
De acuerdo.
Perfect. The point is about the development of existence of rational and conscious humans who value the environment. The environment exists because humans value, recognize, and feel it. Humans are a part of the environment. Whatever happens to the environment has impacts on humans as well, and vice versa. However, humans have the ability to transform the environment. They started this transformation from early times to today. We should not only consider the recent years in this case, but it is not possible for humans to transform and recreate the environment according to their needs. It actually does not mean going backwards, but rather a leap forward in an evolutionary chain.
Yes, it could have happened during the 20th century. Regarding the 21st century, we can mention a chapter of our 2022 Constitution that was rejected. This chapter spoke of the rights of nature, so we must have an equal understanding before the law. Without people, the nature has to be defended or have access to equal judgment. There's a period in which people stop having an anthropocentric vision in the 20th century, and then they believe that humans are a fundamental part of this transformation, but not the only part. I need to emphasize that humans are not the most important ones. If we extrapolate to other values, for example, democratic ones, we understand that in nature these new democratic forms that we need are replicated in the most precise and perfect way. Therefore, we do not necessarily need to be the greatest force, but rather we have to learn to dialogue, share, learn and question what is provided for us by others. All of these points ultimately make up this new paradigm. We believe in it and work for it.
Yes, of course, but finally humans are the ones that will represent non-human interests within nature. And these are the same humans that make legislations for such interests. Humans will provide opportunities for other humans. In short, I believe that it is the human being, the subject and owner of everything. Humans are an indisputable part of the environment. We actually don't destroy the environment, but we damage our own lives. Undoubtedly, human being needs the environment, so he needs a society that generates a certain type of quality and dignity of life. But the human being is the one who decides and determines the transformation. He can even determine the creation of artificial lakes and mountains. He can determine everything. But it does not mean that he is destroying nature. Because nature itself is something that is constantly changing, even without the presence of human being.
Eduardo, under this vision, how does a river return to its source? Here, the role of water is very important. It is no human intervention for a river to flow again where it has flowed for thousands of years.
There are physical and material conditions that determine water under a certain type of amount of accumulation, rain or snow, to have a certain path. Humans have to study this process scientifically, respect it, take it into account, and not build in surrounding areas to prevent catastrophes. Humans should not create an unsuitable environmental situation, because at the end of the day, it impacts all aspects of our life. We have to bear in mind that it profoundly affects the poorest and vulnerable people, because they're the ones who build their houses along the river banks. In short, nature has its course, and humans have to learn from it by achieving necessary science and technology. Human beings must use nature in terms of respect, not the way people are using it right now, which is so bad, because otherwise we destroy our quality of life. This is the relation that exists between human beings and nature.
Pero esa es la relación.
Sin embargo,
it could be considered a fallacious premise that the technology has no limits in its development. This has been proved wrong. We still haven't been able to reach full technological potential in a lot of things.
But technological and scientific capabilities are everlasting and will continue until the last day.
Eso es infinito, hasta que se termine la humanidad.
No necesariamente.
Not necessarily. There are certain natural resources that cannot be recovered.
This is a different issue.
For us, it is part of the same thing, because we understand this as a systemic thought. For instance, we implement extractive projects and deplete natural resources like copper, molybdenum, gold, and lithium. This technical and technological development will end someday. We must pay attention to the fact that close to 70% of the water used at the mine's sites cannot be recovered, not even for human consumption. We're setting scientific limits on these technical, economic, and social developments.
In these few minutes that are left for us, please explain to us the major challenges that you see in the environmental movement in view of this great social upheaval, exclusively with the danger of a world war.
Probably the majority of your audience is in Chile, so the first change we face in Chile today is related to the access to water. In our country, there are 300,000 people who do not have access to water. It's a challenge that bears relations to human rights and quality of life. If we extrapolate this issue to a global context, we're seeing that the current climate crisis is going to cause a number of changes in ways of life that are inevitably going to lead to higher levels of conflict. We shall be capable of observing such dangerous signs. We don't need to foresee, because the disaster is in front of our eyes. The problem is that we don't see it every day. For instance, the temperature rises to a certain degree that the body of the human being can't tolerate anymore, but the planet as a whole can put up with that. We have to be aware of the disasters. I think that it is the second challenge that we face nowadays. As I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, we have to be able to understand the system as a whole. We should understand the socio-environmental conflicts beyond environmental activism, union policies, and the current system. This is the most major challenge in our times, where certain identity politics is imposed. We have to look at this again in a systemic and complementary way in which each part functions as a micro-universe, but at the same time influences what happens around it.
Is it possible to improve the quality of the environment by continuing with the current social, economic, and political systems that exist in most countries?
It's absolutely impossible, because these systems caused this crisis.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Cristobal. I hope you continue your work in the environmental movement. Until next time on Black and White.
Thank you, Eduardo. I wish you the best.
Thank you.
In the limelight.
In the United States, FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell says the Federal Emergency Management Agency's disaster fund may be depleted by mid-September. in a matter of weeks. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA's disaster fund, could dry up within weeks and delay the federal response to natural disasters, the agency's administrator warned on Sunday, 20th of August. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell told CBS's Face the Nation program that the agency is watching its disaster relief fund very closely ahead of hurricane season, and that some recovery projects that are not life-saving measures could be delayed into the next fiscal year if funding falls short. Our estimates do still say that we may have a depletion of our fund. Now it's pushed into the middle of September, Deanne Criswell said. And as we get closer to that, this is a day-to-day monitoring of the situation. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, there were 15 weather or climate disaster events this year before 8th of August, with each causing more than $1 billion worth of damage. The tally does not include the recent wildfires on Maui, Hawaii, which decimated Lahaina, causing an estimated $6 billion in damage to the coastal city. The peak of hurricane season is not until 11th of September. President Joe Biden asked Congress early this month for $12 billion to replenish the disaster fund to address the response to the wildfires and other natural disasters. Congress is on recess until after Labor Day. Deanne Criswell says the amount may not be enough. The $12 billion was going to be able to cover some of the immediate needs that we were going to need to get through this fiscal year, she said, as we are continuing to see the increasingly severe weather events, that dollar amount may need to go up as we go into the next fiscal year. Criswell is traveling with President Joe Biden to Maui, Hawaii on Monday to view the devastation and meet the survivors. The biggest thing that the president needs to see is just the actual impact, Criswell says, of the importance of the visit to Hawaii. It really feels different when you're on the ground and can see the total devastation of Lahaina. He'll talk to some of the families that have been impacted by this disaster and hear their stories. He's really going to be able to, one, bring hope to the community, but also reassure them that the federal government is there. He has directed them to bring the resources they need to help them as they begin to start their recovery and their rebuilding process. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, responds to wildfires. It is also preparing for the really significant impact of Tropical Storm Hilary on Southern California. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell says, "We had a lot of staff already on the ground in California. We're moving in some additional resources to make sure that we can support anything that California might need. But they're a very capable state as well, and they have a lot of resources. So if it does exceed what their capability is, we're going to have additional search and rescue teams, commodities on hand to be able to go in and support anything that they might ask for." United Press International, UPI, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Compounding natural disasters spurred on by extreme weather may lead to the Federal Emergency Management Agency's disaster fund becoming completely depleted within weeks, FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell has said. Appearing on CNN's Face the Nation program, Deanne Criswell on Sunday, 20th of August, said the disaster fund is projected to run dry by mid-September, but the situation is day-to-day. And as we get closer to that, this is a day-to-day monitoring of the situation, but we'll start to move some of our recovery projects and delay them until the next fiscal year. When asked by CNN's Casey Hunt what the Federal Emergency Management Agency would do in the event of a government shutdown, Deanne Criswell said FEMA will continue to push projects into the next fiscal year so it can continue to respond to disasters immediately. We will take measures to ensure that there is always going to be enough funding to continue to support immediate responses to these types of severe weather events, she said. The projections come as Tropical Storm Hilary reached Mexico's Baja California Peninsula and heads towards Southern California, where it may drop up to 4 inches of rain per hour, causing flash floods. There have been 15 weather-related or climate disaster events that caused more than $1 billion worth of damage this year prior to 8th of August, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA. The combined disaster cost is currently more than $39 billion. Last week, the Biden administration requested $12 billion to fund the Federal Emergency Management Agency as it undertakes recovery efforts related to multiple natural disasters. Deanne Criswell, FEMA's administrator, says the agency's response to crises will not be impacted, despite the House and Senate being in recess